Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast on this very special day. The day we're recording, it's over in America. It's the 9th of March, or 3/9, which makes it Hatsune Miku Day. Yay! It's a good day. It's a very special day. It's the best day of the year, basically. With us this week, we've got a pretty large group this week. We've got Harvard. Hello, Harvard.
Hello. I have never heard of Hatsune Miku Day before, but happy Hatsune Miku Day.
It is a very happy day, and welcome to the club of all things Miku knowledge. We also have Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hello, and apologies because if I sound sick, because I just seem to have picked up a cold in like the last 30 seconds.
Oh, well, that's no good. That's what happens when you come on the DDNet podcast. You get sick. It's like a weird ring thing. You jump on the podcast and you die a week later. And we also have a new person on the podcast who hasn't been on before, Sean. Hello, Sean.
Hey, everybody. I'm here to represent all the Americans who have no idea about Miku. So I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, you all say that now, but you watch. A year or two from now, everyone will forget about Christmas and they'll just be celebrating Hatsune Miku Day. That's where things are going. So you might as well just embrace it as far as I'm concerned. Sean is, he actually once upon a time, a long time ago, he actually wrote for DDNet. He now writes for We Got This Covered, which is a very fine website. And I do recommend everyone check it out. Of course, after you finish listening to the podcast, listen to us first. So we're going to jump to Miku music, given it's Hatsune Miku Day and stuff. And this is a good track. This one is from Future Tone and stuff. You probably heard it if you're a fan. If not, well, enjoy. It's a great song. And we'll come back and we'll start talking about Nintendo.
We'll be right back.
And welcome back, everybody. Okay, so last week there was a Nintendo Direct. Nintendo likes to do those at odd times and everybody gets all excited. And this week, this time around, it was looking at a mix of 3DS and Switch games for some reason, and I don't know why. Nintendo seems to still think it needs to support the 3DS. I don't get it, but they do. And there was a couple of new 3DS games announced. And then there was bits and pieces announced for the Switch as well. And yeah, it was interesting, I guess. Harvard, what did you think of the show?
Oh, I thought it was a really quite varied show. I was, to be honest, kind of worried that they were going to stick to their gun and be like, we're making Mario Tennis, we're doing Splatoon, and let's see 15 minutes of footage of each of those. But we actually got a lot of interesting footage from different different IPs. Good to see some old ones coming back, some new ones as well, like that sushi game that I don't know a lot about. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. Lots to look forward to this year.
Yeah. Sushi Strikers looks like crazy good fun. I can't wait for that one, to be honest. That was definitely one of the highlights of the show for me. I don't know when comes out in a couple of months. I think it's not too long away, and that'll be a good one to show. That was basically a combative match three, I guess. You compete against somebody else. There's a sushi rolling from one side of the screen to the other on a train, and you need to match the same type of sushi together. You do that, you get an attack, which you can then throw at your opponent, and whoever eats the sushi the best, I guess, gets to win the round. It's got online multiplayer and stuff, and it's colorful and bright and crazy, and it should be good. The reason that we have Sean on the show this week, to be honest, is that he saw Captain Toad and just wants to talk about it. I don't think there's a bigger Captain Toad fan out there. So, obviously that was a good show for you with Nintendo announcing it for both the Switch and the 3DS.
Yeah, up until that point, I was just kind of sitting there, not really excited for anything. Actually, you did a better job of explaining Sushi Striker than the Nintendo Direct did, which, thank you, because I had no idea what you do in that game. Those who might remember, I think I reviewed Captain Toad for DDNet way back in the day, and I was a big fan of it. So I'm glad that they're finally porting it over, both to 3DS and Switch, which I thought was an odd choice, because, as Matt said, Nintendo seems very keen on keeping the 3DS alive and relevant, even though it really isn't, I'm sad to say. Also, glad to see that there's a new WarioWare game, which is only for 3DS, which is, once again, another very odd choice. You think that would work really well on the Switch, but I guess not.
Yeah. I guess time for me to be a bit controversial. I can't stand WarioWare, but good to see that it is still out there and happening for people who are fans of it. It's odd that it is a 3DS game because, yeah, I don't know. I love the 3DS and all that, and it's given me many years of enjoyment, but it is a legacy console now. So it's odd that Nintendo comes out and tries to support it, especially when it is a portable, and the Switch is also effectively a portable console. So I guess that they don't want to annoy people who already have 3DSs and haven't upgraded to the Switch yet. Maybe they don't want to feel like they're abandoning that audience, but no other company supports legacy consoles quite like Nintendo's trying to do with this one. So yeah.
Just do it, Nintendo. Go ahead and abandon them.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. put Dylan's and stuff on the Switch, because Dylan was another one that was announced. Way back when the 3DS was new.
Well, each other had like six games, and you had to buy everything that came out.
Yeah, when the 3DS was like failing in the market, and you basically bought anything that Nintendo threw out there, it created a new franchise, Dylan's Rolling Western, and that was a mix of action game and tower defense, and it was quite interesting, and it was decent fun. It had a lot of flaws, but it was decent. So a lot of people were waiting to see if that franchise would continue, whether Nintendo would make a new one for the Switch or whatever, and they have announced a new one, but again, it's a 3DS exclusive, which is just odd. And on top of that, it's also a Mii. It makes use of Miis, which is really odd because I thought Nintendo was killing Miis off bit by bit by removing everything that has Miis in them. Another odd announcement.
Another thing I found weird is they're remastering another Mario and Luigi game, which you can technically play on your 3DS already if you just find the DS cartridge. You know what I mean? I think it's the Bowser Inside Story. And not only have they announced that for next year's release, so clearly they're not getting rid of the 3DS anytime soon. You can still play that game right now if you just find a cartridge.
Yeah, that was so weird. It's like a 2019 release on the 3DS. What? Just what? I don't understand that at all. I can kind of understand that maybe they release a couple of games through 2018 just to keep it going on. But 2019 is just, it's just odd. Odd. And Matt, what about you? What tickled your fancy from the Direct?
Well, I didn't actually watch the Direct because I was at work at the time and stuck in a meeting. happening, but I read about the announcements and stuff afterwards. And yeah, I think there wasn't anything that really stood out to me. I have not played Captain Toad, and now I finally will because it'll come when it comes out on Switch. So that's exciting. But aside from that, nothing really jumped out at me. I was hoping for, as I say, like every time we have a podcast and talk about Nintendo, I was waiting for some sort of announcement about Virtual Console, but that didn't happen. And I was waiting for some sort of announcement about Tokyo Mirage Sessions on Switch, and that didn't happen. I guess Crash Bandicoot is mildly exciting because I enjoy those games. But I mean,
that was a surprise. Yeah.
Yeah, there wasn't really anything. Yeah.
They are slowly working through the remasters. Captain Toad is obviously originally a Wii U game, and now it's on Switch. So there's hope yet that we'll see the three, I think, that we agree that we both kind of want to see on the Switch, which being Xenoblade Chronicles, Tokyo Mirage Sessions, and Fatal Frame. There's hope yet. It might be faint hope, but it's hope. And then, of course, the big and one more thing at the end of the show was the announcement of a Smash Brothers for Nintendo Switch. And, of course, the internet went into meltdown after that, which I find odd because all that Nintendo showed in that video was the logo, the Smash Brothers logo. And, yes, they had, like, the Splatoon characters are quite obviously going to be in it. But other than that, there was absolutely nothing announced about this game. And anybody who didn't think that Nintendo was working on another Smash Brothers is a little bit loopy in the head. So, yeah, there was actually nothing new in that announcement. And yet people got absolutely, you know, they went berserk over it. So I don't get it. It wasn't a surprise to me. Nintendo's working on Smash Brothers. Yeah.
I think the big surprise was just that they confirmed it is coming out this year. Other than that, I think most people kind of expected it would arrive. I just don't think we knew when.
Yeah, I'll believe that it's coming out this year when it actually comes out this year, I think.
Probably like Q2, Q3 next year, let's be real.
Yeah. I'm looking at the press release, so I'm hoping it says 2018, assuming they don't like muck that up somehow. But fingers crossed for them to like stick by their word, so.
Yeah, and the thing is, if it is a 2018 release, I wonder about what's going to be in it because, you know, it hasn't been that long since the last one was wrapped on development. So whether this is effectively, you know, an enhancement on the Wii U and 3DS one, or whether it is a whole new game, is going to be, I don't know. I think that it was too vague to get really excited about until we see more details. One would assume E3 would be when that happens. But yeah, I don't know. For me, the overall, the thing about this Direct was that this was meant to be, you know, giving people more details about what's happening through 2018 with Nintendo. And, you know, last year we had Zelda, Mario, Fire Emblem Warriors, Splatoon 2. We had an awful lot of great games on the Switch. And this year they spent 15 minutes telling us more about a tennis game, which looks pretty lousy. So, yeah, there's a long way for Nintendo to go to back up what it did last year with the Switch, as far as I'm concerned. And that tennis game really does look terrible.
But really that does. Being said,
it looks like the best tennis game ever made.
Go on Google, look for the Chain Chomp tennis playoff, because I will watch a Chain Chomp playing tennis for half an hour, and that will be the best Direct I've ever seen. It is so good.
Yeah. I don't know. The thing with, like, the original Mario Tennis was a great game, the one way back on the N64, and they also did a great job with the Game Boy and the Game Boy Advanced ones, because they were like RPG things as well. But since then, Mario Tennis has just become like an endless escalation of gimmicks, and they've never actually done anything to make the actual tennis game any more engaging. In fact, if anything, it's going backwards. It becomes more and more like Pong every year.
That's because tennis isn't very much fun, so there's not much they can do with it.
Oh, Matt.
I kid. I just say things like that to get Matt riled up. One thing I'm surprised
hot takes are coming thick and fast.
One thing I haven't heard you surprised that I haven't heard you talking about, Matt, is the No More Heroes. Travis Strikes Again.
I have no idea what the fuck that game's even about.
Neither do I. I just
it was like a it was like a minute of footage that we saw, and it just looks like, I don't know. I do not know what that game is. I'm sure I'll like it because it's Goichi Suda, but what?
I'll tell you right now, the press release makes it even more confusing. As I mentioned, it contains a total of 7 game titles, including an action, racing, and puzzle game. So I don't know if it's like a mini game compilation or what's going on, but it's even more confusing now as to what that game actually is.
Yeah, I learned a long time ago with Goichi Suda games to not think about them until you play them. Because the more you think about them, the more confused you're going to get. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be great. I'm sure it will be great. He doesn't do much wrong. But I just don't know what that was about. what else did we get? We got a confirmed release date for Octopath Traveler, which was cool. It's actually coming sooner than I thought, which is great because that game looks good. And the demo was equally impressive. So that'll be good. And what else? Oh, Little Nightmares and Undertale coming to the Switch. Those are both very, very good games. So having them on the go will also be good.
I wonder if they'll get a lot of buyers, because when the Switch started out, a lot of indie games were doing really well because there wasn't a lot else in the eShop. And now every week you see like 20 indie games come out on the eShop.
Yeah. I think Undertale and Little Nightmares will be all right. I think those games were received well enough and have a good enough reputation, they'll probably sell to a lot of people who just want them on the go, which is fine, which is good.
I was going to say, there's not a lot of horror games from what I can recall on Switch right now, so I'm hoping Little Nightmares can find a good home on the Switch, because it kind of fills that void.
Yeah, most of the horror games on the Switch are pretty bad.
Is that one called Hollow, I think?
Yeah, the one out of five.
The one Matt loved.
just stop. It does have detention. Detention's great. If you haven't,
just play it. It's really good.
It's not a game from the Direct, but it's on the Switch right now. Go and download it if you haven't played it before, because it's really good. And then finally, because we're going to some music from the game, Okami is also coming out on the Switch. That was announced at the Direct. And I know there's like 70 versions of that game out there by now, but you might as well grab this one too, because it is a really wonderful game, one of the best ever made, and having that on the Switch will be good. So we pick some music from that, and enjoy, and we'll be back soon. Welcome back, everybody. So for the next section of the podcast this week, we thought we'd actually talk about terrible games. So basically, everybody on the team kind of has games that we recognize are not good from a standard gameplay kind of point of view. But we love them anyway for one reason or another. So we thought we'd have a chat about why we might like a game that's not great, or what about it redeems it or makes it playable, or even causes us to love it. The reason that we decided to do this podcast section is because we've spent a lot of time over the last week or so talking about Ace of Seafood on the TDNet Slack. It's an interesting game. It's on the Switch and PS4 and stuff. I picked it up I picked it up for free, actually, thanks to that new system that the Switch has where you can trade in gold coins that you get when you buy games for points and stuff. And I've got enough points to grab Ace of Seafood. So I downloaded it on Ginny's recommendation. And, yeah, it's nuts. It's crazy. It's terrible. It's a really, really bad game. And yet I can't stop playing it because it's so weird. It's just funny. Sean, has there ever been a game that you've really enjoyed, even though you recognize that it's pretty poor?
I think there are a few. The first one that always springs to mind, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's come up before, but Deadly Premonition is still the greatest game ever, regardless of what anybody continues to tell me. Also, I'm a big fan of 50 Cent Blood on the Sand.
Yes.
Third-person shooter starting the G unit with 50 Cent leading the pack through some sort of fictional Middle Eastern country to get a skull back that is, you know, studded with a ton of diamonds. Pretty awful game, but it's great to see a few hip-hop artists just kind of swear for like 6 to 8 hours on end. Those are two that come to mind. I think the last one, which is a little contentious because it's a good game, it's just not a good game for the series, which would be the third Banjo-Kazooie game, Nuts and Bolts, for those who haven't played it. It is not a platforming game, but a vehicle sandbox game where you essentially construct vehicles out of Lego pieces to complete objectives. Probably one of the most hit-or-miss games I've played in my life. A lot of people love it, and then a lot of people hate it. Depending on what your expectations were going into it.
Going back to Deadly Premonition, that's a really interesting one, isn't it? Because that game does not play well at all. It's got open world stuff that doesn't work particularly well. It's got car driving mechanics that are just all over the place. And the actual shooting in the action sequences are not great, but it is a brilliant game because it's just written so well. And it takes the kind of the Twin Peaks aesthetic, I guess, and does a really good job of appropriating it and putting its own spin on it. And it's got, you know, strong surrealist moments. It's well written. It's got great characters. And yeah, I would actually say it's a good game, but not in a conventional sense. That's obviously why it's a difficult one for a lot of people, because it depends, I guess, on whether you care about the kind of the gameplay side of things or the storytelling narrative side of things, because I don't know. it's a difficult one.
No, yeah, you definitely hit the nail on the head. And oddly enough, most of the people I find that like that game are also huge fans of Twin Peaks, which is kind of a TV show that probably doesn't need to be a TV show because it doesn't follow, you know, your traditional TV show conventions. But no, yeah, I'm a big fan of Deadly Premonition. I wish, I always don't know how to pronounce the creator's name. I want to say it's Swery or Swery65, one of the two. I really hope he gets to make something else in the future, because I'd just love to see more for him. I think he tried to kickstart a game recently that did not work out so well.
Yeah, I think he's got another Kickstarter out there at the moment, which I think, I don't know, I haven't checked in on it in a while, actually.
He had that The Good Life on, not Kickstarter, it was that other weird one.
I think it was on Fig.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah.
Which
I quickly jumped over to his Twitter. It seems like he's trying to crowdfund it again at the end of March. So we should probably hear something about it in 2 to 3 weeks' time.
He made the mistake of trying to raise the amount of money it actually costs to make a game rather than like 1% of the cost of making a game.
He also tried to get everybody to sign up for yet another account on the internet, which probably didn't work out so well.
Yeah, probably should have just stuck to Kickstarter. Harvard, in terms of, if you're faced with a game that's not good in terms of the gameplay perspective, for you, what would make you forgive it? Or in what way would you still be able to find something to enjoy about it if it doesn't play well by conventional standards?
Okay, so the rule I usually have is that if one part of the game, if the thing that the game is trying to do is done, then the rest of it isn't. If it's good, then awesome. But if it's a bit janky, then I'm okay with that. So I played a game on the Switch this week called Radiation Island, and it's this amazing B-movie story about like a battleship that ends up on an island full of zombies, and you need to craft your survival out of trees and stuff. And the actual feedback loop is really good. You need to get resources to get more higher grade resources to defend yourself. But the assets, and especially like the enemy AI and stuff, is really, really janky, but you forgive it because it works. And yeah, a lot of other sites haven't been very kind to it, but I actually enjoy my time a lot.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of B grade, a game I really got a good kick out of was that Schoolgirl Zombie Hunter. That was released on PS4 last year, and on every level, it's a pretty terrible shooter. It's so bugged and flawed that it's really difficult to play at times. But it amused me. It amused me greatly. It was so B grade and so over the top and so ridiculous that I couldn't help but enjoy my time with it. So yeah, I could totally get where that comes from. And it's interesting, as critics to review those kinds of things, because if we enjoyed it, we enjoyed it. So we can't really not give it a positive review. But at the same time, obviously, we recognize that these kinds of games have flaws. So how we go about writing those reviews is always an interesting process, I think.
Actually, I've got one more recommendation. So this is a mad deep cut, but if you've ever got a Game Boy Advance, and you've ever seen like the 20 or so Yu-Gi-Oh! Games that got released, a couple of those were made by this developer who clearly did not understand how to play Yu-Gi-Oh! But they made the game anyway. So it's like it doesn't follow the rules of the card game. It follows its own rules. Like sometimes elements are good against each other where that's never been a thing. And a lot of the fun is trying to figure out what the game thinks is the right way to play Yu-Gi-Oh! I think one of them is called the Sacred Cards, but there's a bunch of them that are like that. And this is really stupid of me, but I actually really enjoyed that. It makes no sense, but it was so fun.
Yeah. What about you, Matt? Are there any games that you think are bad, but you enjoyed anyway?
I'm trying to think about this, and I'm struggling to come up with things. The problem
you are the guy that gave I Am Mayo 5 out of 5 stars, so.
Yeah, but that's not a bad game in any way possible. I think that's the thing, is that, I don't know, most games that, I guess I Am Mayo is bad if you want to be really conventional about it. So that would fit, I guess. And not really a sequel, but the newer game from that developer, Mr. Misagi, is similarly ridiculous and maybe a bit worse in that it's more gamey. So I Am Mayo is basically just, it's a clicker game. It's a game that involves tapping a mayo jar thousands of times by pressing a button on the controller. So if you're looking at it as a game, it's probably quite boring, but finds lots of ways to find humor in it, and it's very clever. But Mr. Misagi is more It's basically a parody of dating sims. So you can fail the game, first of all, is basically by choosing the wrong options in the dialogue choices. You end up not succeeding on your date and not getting the massage you were promised. But the actual, the dates themselves are so ridiculous that it's impossible to really know, particularly for the hard ones, it's impossible to like predict and choose the right options without just going through like trial and error, because when you're dating a body pillow that doesn't talk, there is not really much indication of what are the right or wrong things to say to win this date. So it ends up basically becoming trial and error. But then that's a very deliberate kind of effort to satirize the whole genre, and it avoids being tedious because each date is like a couple of minutes long, so there's not much lost by failing.
Wait, Matt, you mean to tell me that a game about dating a body pillow is not serious? It's satirical?
Well, I guess it's serious if you want it to be. I took it very seriously. You can also, there's also a ghost and a werewolf.
And the mayo jar.
And the mayo jar, yes. And a cow who thinks she's human and doesn't realize that she's a cow.
See, maybe that's the thing. Maybe the simple thing is that people need to stop trying to apply the kind of the rules for what makes a good game to games and just embrace the weird sometimes. Maybe that's the thing. Maybe there aren't so many bad games. Maybe there aren't even, you know, any bad games. Maybe it's all just a matter of perspective. Well, actually, no, there is one bad game. Bravo Team is objectively bad, and anybody who likes it is just wrong.
What about Bricks 2?
And Bricks 2 is pretty...
Or that Llama game. I kind of...
Or the Llama game. Bored. I've played a lot of really bad games. That bad game.
It's all because he said Bricks 2 was the worst game of the year. They're going to come for you now.
Yeah.
I know. I
declared the worst game of the year in January.
Yeah. I was just asking Karma to get back at me for that, I guess. And now they're punishing me badly. Bad games. But there is a difference between those games and good bad games.
There is.
Like Ace of Seafood is a good bad game.
That's a game that seems like deliberately bad. It was made to be bad and to just run with that and have fun with it.
I think that's a thing. I think there's a difference between a developer trying to do something good and failing, i.e. Bravo Team, Bricks, Llama game, whatever. There's a difference in tone between a game that's earnestly trying to do something and failing, and then a game that the developers realize is going to be shit and they just run with it and have fun with it and spin it into something that's wholly entertaining of its own right. Basically, anything that's kind of B-grade in style, usually the people who make it know that it's not AAA or whatever you want to call it, and they just play with it, and as a result, it has that sense of fun, and if you're in the right mood, you can really get along with it. So, yeah. All right. On that note, let's go to some music from a good game. Final Fantasy 14, I think. We haven't had music from that game for a while. And if we're actually going to cover off all the music in the podcast, we need to get cracking, because with about 7,400 different music tracks, it's going to take us a while to run through them all. This is kind of the opening theme song thing, which is very lovely. I had a chance to listen to it live in an orchestra last year when I went to a Final Fantasy 14 concert, and they got the original singer out, and yeah, it's just an amazing song. So enjoy, and we'll be back to talk about Life is Strange.
Yeah. walked before to lead those who walk after.
So, this week we thought we'd take a look at Life is Strange. This is the original one we're talking about because the prequel is out in a limited edition physical thingy now, and we're all playing through that. And we thought we'd take a look back at the original because the original is still an amazing game. There'll probably be spoilers as we chat about it, so if you haven't played it yet, I don't know why you're waiting, but go out and do so and then come back and listen because... Yeah, we're all big fans of that game. It was an interesting one, wasn't it? Because before it came out, we were all thinking it was going to be some kind of adventure game. But I kind of want to say that it was almost like it was closer to a visual novel in style, really, in terms of the way it told its story. And I don't know. I didn't. Once I started playing, I realized I enjoyed it more than I would an adventure game because it didn't have those stupid puzzles and stuff which generally hold back adventure games for me, and I was able to just focus on the storytelling, and it was a pretty incredible story actually.
It had its own sort of puzzles, but they were part of the dialogue, so
they were easy puzzles. Yeah. They weren't puzzles you had to think about too much. They were just there because maybe it felt like they had to put some interactivity in there, but it was really they just wanted people to focus on the story still, so they didn't want people to get stuck on annoying puzzles. I hate puzzles in the adventure game. I just hate them.
You and me both.
I don't know. For me, it felt like it felt quite cinematic, which is what I really liked about Life is Strange. It felt like, I don't know if you guys have all seen like The Virgin Suicides, the film, that kind of aesthetic, that kind of very normal school life offset against something, very weird happening in the background. And then had that kind of light and airy presentation, which made it all look very sterile and pleasant and kind of idealized. And then that made the impact of the kind of the dark stuff happening underneath quite significant. That was the way I kind of took it.
Yeah.
If anybody wants to jump in.
having a moment reminiscing with all those films, I think.
No, that was what was going on in my mind. But to add to what Matt said, and I think Matt, you may have made a video at some point in your life about the opening credits of the game.
I just threw those up.
I think that kind of it's probably one of the best openings in a game because it so quickly establishes the tone it's going for, where you have, the normal everyday high school life, which most people are just trying to survive through high school, lined up and juxtaposed with this weird flashback time travel stuff you don't really know what's going on with. And I think I should probably say, I think I've only played the first two episodes of Life is Strange, but spoilers be damned. I'll listen to the whole conversation that's about to unfold. But just looking back on high school, at least for me, I think everybody, when they go through high school, tries to focus or spends too much attention focusing on themselves because they think, their life's going on the worst or they have all the problems in the world. I really like Life is Strange for, at least in the opening episodes, focusing on even the most minor of characters. I believe there was one character, and admittedly, I don't know how how it all pans out. I believe there was one character who may have been pregnant. Am I crazy or am I getting somewhere here with the plot? Because it's been months since I've played the opening episode, but for what I remember, you could completely miss that entire thing unfolding because you'd have to look at some very some clues that could be completely missed. Am I ringing a bell here, or am I just going crazy?
I think so. It's actually been a while since I played it as well. Hey,
I don't remember pregnant girl, but I mean the thing is, and what you're totally right about is. This game is one that really rewards people for paying attention beyond what's immediately in front of them. I'll give you an example, and again, spoilers, and that's the last time I'm going to say it. So if you get angry at the podcast now because we spoil stuff, well, you've been warned and just pay attention next time. In the second episode, I believe it is, you are in your dorm room at the start of the game because you're Max, obviously. Max being the protagonist. And if she, if you have her look out the window, way down in the corner of the window, what you see outside, a guy, the Warren, who's meant to be like your buddy, and your friend and stuff, he's actually peeking around a corner, kind of looking up at your window. And oh, that just gives, yeah, that just gives like this completely different tone to Warren. And if you miss it, he still seems like, you know, the nice dude in through all the conversations and stuff. And, you know, you just get a totally different perception of him if you notice that, as opposed to if you don't. And that's what I really love about Life is Strange, because it's just, there's so much normalcy in it that if you're not paying attention, a lot of the seedier stuff that happens in the world, you miss. But if you are paying attention, it gives you a completely different look on the environments and the characters and stuff, which is really impressive. It's very clever, clever way of telling story when a lot of games are very explicit about stuff. Like any other game would force you to go over and look at the window and then force you to see Warren and then force you to draw conclusions about what he's doing. And Life is Strange just leaves it up to the player to determine those things.
I'm clearly not very observant because I didn't see that, and I didn't see the pregnancy stuff either. I thought Warren was really creepy anyway, but maybe that was just me.
He just had that
vibe about him.
It's funny. Everybody's mentioning they missed the pregnancy stuff, and maybe this is why Life is Strange is so brilliant in its execution, is apparently you need to happen upon the pregnancy test and then use the rewind mechanic to avoid being caught and then bring it up anyways. And when I now think about it, it's one of the very few games that ties in its mechanics very closely with its how it wants to deliver its narrative, because you'd have to, like, they go hand in hand. Unlike other games, as Matt mentioned, which are going to essentially force you down a road or force you down a path in order to deliver some sort of plot point, there's entire swaths of this game which can just be missed because you didn't pay attention or because you didn't really learn about the mechanics in detail and just didn't think, okay, I need to do this so I won't get caught, so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's interesting because I know you haven't played through the whole game, so you haven't come up to the ending, the fifth chapter. That chapter was very controversial because for a lot of people, they'd been told through the entire game that their decisions really mattered, and then all of that kind of agency is stripped out for the last decision you need to make in the game. And I'm saying that without being too spoilery, actually. I'm impressing myself. you'll realize what I'm talking about when you get up to that bit, Sean. But I like the ending because the ending kind of tied in with the whole game's philosophy. And the kind of the conversations it was having underneath in subtext. But what I really liked about the game was how everything you did had some kind of impact in how the small parts of the story progressed. So I always felt like as I was playing, I was subtly changing things, much more subtly than, say, a David Cage game or something where it's always kind of punching you in the face every time you make a decision.
This one was very subtle. That David Cage games aren't subtle.
Yeah, I'm saying that his games aren't the most subtle out there. I love David Cage games, but he's not the most subtle of.
No, he really isn't.
Storytellers. But this one is very subtle, almost possibly too subtle. I think maybe that's part of the problem, that there's a lot of stuff people missed and they didn't realize that they could do. Because the game was never overt about if you do this, then this will happen, or if you do this, you know, something else will happen. Because the game was never overt about it, a lot of people missed it because, let's face it, most people who play games aren't thinking very well. Geez, I just put half the podcast audience off. Sorry about that. I'm sure all our listeners are just
fire,
I'm sure all of our listeners are the smart ones. But you know what I mean. It's like a lot of people don't come to video games for subtle storytelling. They come to video games because they want to be punched in the face by what they need to know about it as they play. And Life is Strange did things very differently, which I was really impressed with.
I mean, it's got its fair share of face punches as well. I think if you just play the game without looking at the details, there are definitely, you feel the big plot points a lot more, and that I felt, especially after playing, there are a few moments which are a bit manipulative in a way to make you feel like the most the most drama in the moment, like, oh no, your powers suddenly stopped working. What are you going to do? Kind of thing.
Yeah, that only happened once, didn't it? It was like Kate's.
Yeah. But also, there's like certain things, like you're in the situation that is clearly the worst possible thing that could possibly happen. It feels very teen drama in that sense. It kind of loses that slice of life feel that the first episode was really going for.
Well, it is a teen drama. I think.
Maybe I had different expectations of it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the first episode maybe might have set things up to be a little bit different. But I think after that, it does definitely become a teen drama fundamentally. And yeah, I don't know. Like, I, for some reason, as I was playing through Life is Strange, I kept making the right decisions. So I think I was pretty proud of myself as well, as, you know, I was doing a good job at being a teenager. like,
is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know. I was a model citizen, I guess. Like, I don't know. I saved, I helped Kate through her incident successfully. And apparently that was harder to do than I realized because I just made the decisions right. Through the game, and yeah, and then like the dog, and apparently it's quite hard not to do things to the dog, and I managed to not do them, so yeah, I don't know. I was a very good teen, obviously, and playing as myself in this game, I seem to get through okay. So
actually, on the note, I really like how at the end of every chapter it shows you the percentages of all the other players and how they made choices in certain moments, because I think the thing about the time rewinding mechanic is that you get to go back and change what you did. So you, whatever you decide is the main timeline, like whatever you decide to keep going along with is a choice that you have to own, because you could have at any time gone back and changed it. So the game puts you through all these tough decisions where you're not really satisfied with either outcome, but you have to pick what feels right for you. And I think it's really interesting to then go to the end of the game and see whether other people thought the same as you. So like whether you thought this person was a good or a bad person, whether you wanted to protect yourself or to protect your friends, stuff like that. That was really interesting. I actually haven't had an experience like that in any other game.
Yeah, I mean, the Telltale games all do the same thing. They tell you what things people have chosen to do as they played, but Telltale games are not exactly subtle about the decisions.
Yeah,
either,
it
never feels rewarding.
Feel like there's a right and wrong to them, or at least like a main pathway, and Life is Strange is more of like a... you kind of make your own story almost, except you don't, but you know.
Yeah, especially more recent Telltale games, they're always quite obvious about which option the developer kind of wants you to choose to push the direction, the narrative in the right direction. Whereas Life is Strange does leave it much more open. I think this will probably be something Matt wants to talk about, but the characters in Life is Strange is also one of the most important or one of the most impressive elements about the game, because they're so different to normal video game protagonists and antagonists in that they are just so normal and relatable. And I think that's something that obviously got a lot of people, because, you know, with most of us, I guess, have been Max at some point in our lives, and we certainly resonated with what she was going through.
My controversial opinion that Matt and Harvard know well is that I can't stand Max. I just found her really not relatable, I don't know what that says about me, because everyone else seems to love her and find her incredibly relatable. She just seemed very plain, and not plain as in... plain isn't like kind of underdeveloped, and like she basically was there to be almost a silent protagonist, almost a Link and Zelda kind of project yourself onto this character, which I don't really like. And so all throughout the whole thing, Chloe was really the character that got me hooked into it, and that
Are you sure it's Chloe? Are you sure it's not like Nick, because you're secretly a jock, or you were through your school life, and that's why you don't relate to Max, because you're actually the one bullying poor old Max's? Are you sure about this?
I'm sure. I was a jock for about 2 years of my life in my early 20s. I was I was the one getting bullied when I was in high school. But yeah, I don't know. I found Max very, what's the word? I found it very annoying and unrelatable. And I played for the moments when Chloe was in the game. And so it's no surprise that I like the prequel a lot more. I mean, I really like the game, but I didn't think Max was the best protagonist for it. I'm going to really annoy you now, Matt. She reminded me of Vaan in Final Fantasy XII.
Yeah, that's pretty bad, man.
And that she seemed like basically like a vessel to witness somebody else's story, and that being Chloe's story.
Yeah, I don't know. I've got this copy of Life is Strange Before the Storm sitting here right in front of me, and I'm really, really concerned about putting it on because that game is focused on Chloe and her story, and I'm kind of the opposite to you, Matt. I really can't stand Chloe as somebody who identifies, I guess, with Max. And Max was, you know, she's creative, she's kind of good at study, you know, she's into her photography and her arts and all that kind of stuff. As somebody who kind of relates to Max, the one thing I found unbelievable about Life is Strange is the relationships that she had with Chloe, because I don't know, I wouldn't have, I think, back in school, like the kind of the punkish anarchist style person that Chloe was, which was an act, of course, because as we find out later on, she obviously is a well-developed character and stuff, but yeah, that kind of personality, I didn't get the relationship between those two as something believable. I felt like they wouldn't have connected in real life in any kind of scenario, I guess. So yeah, I don't know. I mean I guess
the thing there is, and the prequel does elucidate this more, is that the punkish thing sort of
came in later,
sort of after Max had left, and Max leaving was part of that. So like when they were friends as young kids, they were just more like normal young kids playing at being pirates.
Yeah, I can see that. And I mean, like, the actual base Life is Strange does look into that kind of stuff a little bit with some of the flashbacks, but yeah, it was hard to get a real sense of their relationship dynamic and who Chloe really was through that game. So I don't know, maybe I will like Before the Storm, and maybe I'll have a very different view of Chloe afterwards. Who knows? Fingers crossed.
I mean, it also probably just different people and different perspectives, because the whole like the stepdad kind of struggle was something I think I related to a lot, and I found a lot of value in the way that explored that, like her Chloe's dynamic with what's his name, David, is that his name?
David.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was an odd one, wasn't he? He was one of the best written characters, I thought, through the game, because I just couldn't figure him out. Yeah, I couldn't figure him out while I was playing. Like even right at the end, I still wasn't quite sure about this David guy. He was an interesting, a complex and nuanced character. But anyway, okay, so I think we've pretty much tapped out everything we could talk about with Life is Strange, and I'm really impressed.
Probably a lot more we could talk about with Life is Strange, but we're probably running out of time.
We are a bit, and you know, we managed to do it without being too spoilery, yeah, which was pretty impressive. So at the end of it, what happens is, no, I won't do that.
For a minute, I was like, oh man, I'm about to go play it right when we finish. Is he going to spoil it? Turns out
that everyone is an alien.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody's actually
behind the entire time.
Yeah, and Godzilla shows up right at the very end too, you know, just to ruin it for everyone. If you haven't played Life is Strange, play it, because it's really good, and it's a really good example of how narrative can be done in games. And you should play it because the sequel's coming out anyway, so, you know, get yourself ready for that. Should be good. On that note, we'll probably finish with some music from Life is Strange. We might use that opening track, given how good it was. And it introduced me to a new favorite artist. I can't remember his name now, but I actually went and like put all of that guy's music on my Apple Music playlist after playing Life is Strange, because it's really good. It's very folksy. It's great music. Thanks very much for listening, and we will see you next week for the next podcast.